You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, March 27th, 2024. I'm Fiona from Drake University. Here is our first story. It comes from the cover of the Nonpareil for today, and it's called Aviation Programs Soar. This is by Brooklyn Drazy. Adam Townsend has been a mechanic his whole life and plans to turn it into a career upon completion of his training at Indian Hills Community College. Townsend found his passion for aviation in high school, and though he thought about becoming a pilot, aviation maintenance allows him to combine his interests at a college close to home with a good program. Now, in his second year of the program, Townsend is already interning at a company in Des Moines and plans to continue there full-time after graduation. He said the recognition Indian Hills Community College is receiving through a federal grant solidifies his opinion of how good and important the school's training is. It makes me proud, honestly. It makes me feel that much more confident in my schooling and the knowledge that I've absorbed through my professors and through the school, Townsend said. It makes me feel like I'm more prepared. The Federal Aviation Administration has awarded a combined amount of almost $1.3 million to three Iowa community colleges to help update and support their aviation training programs. Indian Hills Community College and Iowa Western Community College in Council Bluffs are receiving $302,816 and $500,000 for their aviation maintenance and mechanics programs, respectively. And Iowa Lakes Community College in Estherville has been awarded $493,657 for its aviation program. Each community college will use funds from the grants to obtain new equipment and technology for their programs, from virtual reality systems to drones. Indian Hills Community College North Campus Program Director Kimberly Dredden said there is a lot of theory involved in the aviation maintenance curriculum that can be hard to understand unless the students can actually see the equipment, which can be difficult since many of the systems are hidden behind walls within the plane. Having new training aids and VR systems will help students better understand what they're working with. Our goal is to use some of these funds to obtain these trainings so students can see how these systems work and what the general flow is, minus just using a diagram, like giving them a very active engagement with it, Dryden said. Equipment like VR technology can also be taken into classrooms to show high school students what they could be doing if they pursue a career in aviation mechanics, and to provide access to people who cannot commute to the college for in-person training. Kyle Norris, an executive dean at Iowa Lake Community College, said the college is planning to expand its aviation programming into emerging technologies like drones and rotary wing piloting, and is opening new aviation cohorts in Spencer and Estherville. One of their goals is to fill the aviation career pipeline and reach more students throughout the region. Drones, simulators, and other technology will help the college engage with more high school students and show them that there isn't just one path for aviation students. This will help us open those doors to high school students that might be thinking of a career in agriculture and then really have a keen interest in the aviation side, and understanding that it doesn't mean flying planes for a commercial industry, Norris said. Promotion of the programs is another area where the colleges will be putting dollars, including expanding partnerships with schools and employers in order to attract students. Diana Garcia, Dean of Industrial Technology and Transportation at Iowa Western Community College, said the college previously used grant dollars from a different FAA grant for the same purpose with positive results. Indian Hills Community College and Iowa Western Community College will also allocate some of the grant dollars to stipends and scholarships for students in order to relieve some of their financial burdens while trying to earn their certifications. Drayden said costs of new tools and even certification examinations can be a barrier for some students, especially if they're handling housing and food costs alongside them, and the college wants to offer support where it can. Like Townsend, Drayden has personal ties to her passion. Growing up with her father and grandfather both involved in aviation mechanics, Drayden knows firsthand the career benefits, but she also knows the barriers it has to people trying to get their start in the industry. Being able to help students receive the tools and access they need to thrive is important, especially in an industry where she said the college, quote, can't give them enough people. Beth Ellman, Marketing Executive Director for Iowa Lakes Community College, said receiving these funds is made even better when she gets to see the passion in students as they experience the college's programming. It's exciting that we're able to have those funds to help catapult the lives of future students, and I think that that's what these grants really mean, Ellman said. They're investing in our program, but really, they're investing in our future, and the future of our students. And there's a couple pictures here with this story. One of them is captioned, Abraham Lincoln High School sophomore Camden Wyant, on the right, and his dad, Tyler, get under the hood of a small plane during an open house for the Iowa Western Community College Aviation Maintenance Program at the school's facility next to the Council Bluffs Municipal Airport on March 18th. And above is pictured Camden and his dad. You can see them in the planes in the background, and then it's close up on the engine there. You can see his dad fiddling with something in the engine, and Camden standing beside him watching. This next story is called Universities Say FAFSA Difficulties Continue, and it's by Brooklyn Drazy. Agriculture has played a large part in Iowa State University student Jennifer Holliday's financial aid over the past few years. The junior and class body president at ISU said coming from a background in livestock and crop farming, scholarships from agricultural organizations and Pell Grants have helped fund her education. However, with changes to the free application for federal student aid, FAFSA, adding the value of a family farm or business to the aid formula, Holliday said she's predicting some changes to how much aid she'll receive this fall. That is, if the form she filled out will ever be taken off hold so she can actually submit it. University officials say glitches are continuing with federal agencies sending incorrect data back to the schools. Despite her sister filing the FAFSA with the same information and having no problems, Holliday is 8 weeks into a waiting period to get information back from the government so she can submit her FAFSA. I also have been talking with a lot of students across Iowa State's body. In my position as student body president, and some of them, I won't go into specifics with their stories or anything, they have the fear that they're going to have to withdraw from college because they're not going to be able to afford to stay, Holliday said. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst said, hearing the impacts these FAFSA changes have had on students like Holliday is a driving factor in her reaching out to the higher education community in Iowa. Their stories are showing that the problems being discussed are real, Ernst said, and will cause some students to hesitate when deciding whether to enroll in college. Ernst joined university students, staff, and leaders at Graceland University Monday to hear their struggles and concerns with the FAFSA, which has seen continuing complications and delays after its rework. Results are finally being sent to schools, but university officials are saying the data they're receiving can't be used to offer aid. The fact that students, whether they've successfully fulfilled their FAFSA or not, still don't know what aid they qualify for is worrisome, University of Iowa Director of Student Financial Aid Brenda Buzinski said. This is due to delays in the FAFSA's release and the disbursement of results to schools, but now that universities are receiving information, some of it isn't accurate. One area of the FAFSA simplification was having the Internal Revenue Service and U.S. Department of Education work together to provide tax information. But, Buzinski said, the wrong information is being pulled for the forms, making it bad data. The federal agencies are also using the formula to calculate aid incorrectly, making it inaccurate, she said. It took the department a week to acknowledge the incorrect information, she said, and she's worried about how much extra work could be put on her staff's plate if the department doesn't take the information back and fix it itself. Right now, the UI is working on what it can control, Buzinski said in an interview, like making sure the financial aid document is correct and ready to go once accurate information is provided. There is currently no timeline for when offers will be sent out. It would be irresponsible if we were to provide financial aid offers based on bad information, and we can't do that, Buzinski said in the discussion. An Iowa State University graduate herself, Ernst said she knows what it's like to rely on federal aid to attend school. At that time, my folks owned and operated a very, very small farm in Montgomery County, and I did receive Pell aid, so it was very helpful for me. I also had some scholarships, and it worked for me, Ernst said. If I had not had that support, I would not have been able to go to college. So really, I understand the impact some of these families are experiencing today. The concern Ernst shared with others at the table was that with these changes to the formula, as well as siblings not being counted on the form, many Iowa students will see more barriers to attending college if they still decide to go at all. Daniel Hetty, National Policy Advisor for the Iowa Farm Bureau, said farmers are big proponents of the do-it-yourself attitude, so they often won't reach out to colleges or organizations for help with things like the FAFSA. However, they also don't know how to address questions asking them to calculate the unharvested value of their crops and other items that don't translate to actual dollars that can be put toward tuition and fees. With a more complicated form that negatively impacts farmers and their families, it's more likely that potential students will just decide to keep working the farm. You shouldn't have to sell the livestock in order to go to college, especially if these sorts of things are out there, Hetty said. And the purpose of these are to provide opportunities to folks, which is pretty frustrating. Rita George, Director of Student Financial Services at Graceland University, said, quote, "The unknowns are a large factor in making students hesitate to even try to get aid in order to pay for schooling. With no aid offers and little information to provide comfort, why would they commit to something they're unsure about being able to afford?" The thing at Graceland that we're seeing, that I think we're seeing across the state, is with the delays and changing timelines and things like now calculation errors and having to go back and redo things, the confidence in the whole process is eroding, Graceland University President Patricia Draves said. Ernst said she and her staff have been working to get more information from the U.S. Department of Education in order to answer questions about the issues in FAFSA data with minimal response. The department seemingly isn't even able to define the term investment farm, she said, which is a problem, as no one else can either, and applicants have questions about it. They plan to send another letter to the department with these stories and concerns and share them with other members of Congress to help bolster bipartisan efforts to address these problems. You are the subject matter experts. I lean heavily on all of you to provide that direction, Ernst said. And that's why my team is here today, to wrap up all of this information, and we'll stick it in yet another letter that I hope they actually read and respond to. And this story also has a picture attached to it. It's captioned, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa speaks with higher education leaders and students at Graceland University on Monday. And it has a picture of the senator, a student, and it looks like a couple of parents sitting at a table and discussing. This next story is titled Nashville School Marks 1 Year Since Shooting. It's by Travis Lawler. Nearly a year after a shooting at a Christian elementary school in Nashville that left 3 adults and 3 children dead, the students and their families have formed tight bonds out of their shared sufferings. They've also adopted a lot of dogs. Among the adopters is Matthew Sullivan, who now cares for a Rhodesian Ridgeback named Hank. He is the chaplain at Covenant School, which endured an all-too-common tragedy on March 27, 2023, when a former student shot through the exterior doors and kept going. Sullivan isn't allowed to talk about what happened inside the building that day, but he says it, and the days that followed, are a blur anyway. Some things stand out, though. He remembers walking to safety with the students in a human chain, and one of them asking, "Where's Evelyn?" He remembers the eerie feeling he got when he realized that head of school, Catherine Kuntz, was not responding on the text thread among the teachers. He remembers the endless waiting at a nearby church as students were slowly reconnected with parents. No one had a comprehensive list of students. It took hours to make sure everyone was accounted for and with their proper guardians. It wasn't until much later that evening that Sullivan learned which of his pupils and colleagues he would never see again. Evelyn Diekhaus, Hallie Scruggs, and William Kinney, all 9 years old, Kuntz, age 60, custodian Mike Hill, age 61, and 61-year-old substitute teacher Cynthia Peake. Now, as the school faces the first anniversary of the tragedy and moves back into the building where it happened, Sullivan says one positive aspect of the past year has been the bond that has grown between families. "It's been an incredible cementing of community, he said. Prayer groups have formed of moms, then of dads, and these people, that's now in their weekly routine without fail. Like, they can't miss it. They don't want to miss it." One day, a group of dads showed up at school asking for the teacher's car keys. They were there to wash and vacuum all the cars. "That never would have happened before," Sullivan said. "Our dads were, I would say, relatively disconnected, but now they're really in touch. Often, they will drop the kids off, but stay for morning chapel, sitting in the back. They bring their coffee and sing the songs and do the silly hand motions," Sullivan said. it's really deepened us in ways that, I mean, it would have been great to not have to go through this to do it, but here we are. Houston Phillips is one of those dads in the back of the chapel. It is for community, but it's also one of those things where, as long as they're going to let me in the school, I'm going to try to be there because of what happened. I want to be close to my son, he said. Like many other dads, he has become very involved with Covenant and close with other families. I was always kind of like, man, I don't have time for the friends that I already have, so making new friends is not something I was very interested in, he said. This next story is part of the Nation and World section of the paper. It's called Judge Issues a Gag Order, and it's by Michael Sisick. A New York judge issued a gag order Tuesday, barring Donald Trump from commenting publicly about witnesses, prosecutors, court staff, and jurors in his upcoming hush money criminal trial, citing the former president's history of, quote, threatening, inflammatory, denigrating remarks about people involved in his legal cases. Judge Juan M. Merchan's decision, echoing a gag order in Trump's Washington, D.C. election interference criminal case, came a day after he rejected the defense's push to delay the Manhattan trial until summer and ordered it to begin April 15th. If the date holds, it will be the first criminal trial of a former president. Given that the eve of trial is upon us, it is without question that the imminency of the risk of harm is now paramount, Merchan wrote in a four-page decision granting the prosecution's request for what is deemed a, quote, narrowly tailored gag order. The judge said the presumptive Republican presidential nominee's statements have induced fear and necessitated added security measures to protect his targets and investigate threats. Trump's lawyers fought a gag order, warning it would amount to unconstitutional and unlawful restraint on his free speech rights. Merchan, who long resisted imposing a gag order, said his obligation to ensure the integrity of the trial outweighed First Amendment concerns. The gag order bars Trump from either making or directing other people to make public statements on his behalf about potential witnesses and jurors in the hush money trial. It also prohibits any statements meant to interfere with or harass the court's staff, prosecution team, or their families. It does not bar comments about Merchan, whom Trump has referred to after his arraignment last year as, quote, a Trump-hating judge with a family full of, quote, Trump haters, or Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, an elected Democrat. But it puts Trump on notice that attacks on key figures in the case, like his former lawyer turned nemesis Michael Cohen or porn star Stormy Daniels, won't be tolerated. A violation could result in Trump being held in contempt of court, fined, or even jailed. I want to thank Judge Merchan for imposing the gag order as I have been under relentless assault from Donald's MAGA supporters, said Cohen, a key prosecution witness against Trump. Nevertheless, knowing Donald as well as I do, he will seek to defy the gag order by employing others within his circle to do his bidding, regardless of consequence. The next story in this section is called Farmers Confront Authorities. It's by Raph Cassert and Mark Carlson. Farmers threw beets, sprayed manure at police, and set hay alight Tuesday as hundreds of tractors again sealed off streets close to the European Union headquarters, where agriculture ministers sought to ease a crisis that led to months of protest across the 27-nation bloc. The farmers protested what they see as excessive red tape and unfair trading practices, as well as increased environmental measures and cheap imports from Ukraine. Let us make a living from our profession, read one billboard on a tractor blocking a main thoroughfare littered with potatoes, eggs, and manure. Police used tear gas and water cannons to keep farmers and some 250 tractors at bay, even as ministers met to push through measures meant to calm the crisis. Authorities asked commuters to stay out of Brussels and work from home as much as possible. Farmers, police, and firefighters had to nurse injuries that were not life-threatening. The government lambasted the farmers for failing to stop violent protesters who threw e-bikes off a bridge and set the entry to a subway station aflame. The violence, arson, and destruction during the protests are unacceptable, said Interior Minister Annelies Verlinden, and insisted the guilty would be prosecuted. With protests taking place from Finland to Greece, Poland, and Ireland, the farmers already won concessions from EU and national authorities from a loosening of controls on farms to a weakening of pesticide and environmental rules. A major EU plan to better protect nature in the bloc and fight climate change was indefinitely postponed Monday, underscoring how the protests have had a deep influence on politics. In order to have a strong Europe, there is a need for a strong agriculture. So we are here to remind them that their farmers should be a priority, said Belgian farmer Yolin Tarje. We are in favor of doing our best for the environment, but still, agriculture should be a priority. EU member states gave their provisional blessings Tuesday to proposals that amount to weakening or cutting rules in areas like crop rotation, soil cover protection, and tillage methods. Small farmers, representing about two-thirds of the workforce and the most active in the protest movement, will be exempt from some controls and penalties. This next story is pretty short. It's called UK Court Won't Send Assange to Be Executed. A British court ruled Tuesday that Julian Assange can't be extradited to the United States on espionage charges unless US authorities guarantee he won't get the death penalty, giving the WikiLeaks founder a partial victory in his long legal battle over the site's publication of classified American documents. Two high court judges said they would grant Assange a new appeal unless US authorities give further assurances within 3 weeks about what will happen to him. The ruling means the legal saga, which has dragged on for more than a decade, will continue, and Assange will remain inside London's high-security Belmarsh prison, where he has spent the past 5 years. Judges Victoria Sharp and Jeremy Johnson said the U.S. must guarantee that Assange, who is Australian, is afforded the same First Amendment protections as a United States citizen, and that the death penalty is not imposed. The U.S. Justice Department declined to comment Tuesday. Assange's supporters said he is a journalist protected by the First Amendment who exposed U.S. military wrongdoing in Iraq and Afghanistan that was in the public interest. The next story is also pretty short. It's called Israel, U.S. at Odds Over Rafah UN Resolution. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Tuesday blasted a UN Security Council resolution calling for a Gaza ceasefire that his country's top ally, the United States, chose not to block the prior day. He claimed the resolution emboldened Hamas, and he vowed to press ahead with the war. As the war grinds through a six-month, both Israel and Hamas rejected international ceasefire efforts. Meanwhile, U.S. defense leaders pressed their Israeli counterparts Tuesday to ensure that any military operation in the southern city of Rafah unfold in phases to protect civilians and secure the delivery of aid, a senior Pentagon official said. Israel's defense minister was receptive, the official said, but it's not clear what impact the meeting will have on Israeli plans for Gaza or on growing tensions between the two nations. The senior defense officially described the 90-minute meeting at the Pentagon as very productive and really quite meaty, but demurred when asked if Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin sought to condition future U.S. military aid to Israel on an improvement of the humanitarian situation in Gaza. This next story is called Ship Demolishes Bridge. It's from Baltimore, and it's by Lee Skeen. A cargo ship lost power and rammed into a major bridge in Baltimore early Tuesday, destroying the span in a matter of seconds and plunging it into the river in a terrifying collapse that could disrupt a vital shipping port for months. Six people were missing and presumed dead. The ship's crew issued a Mayday call moments before the crash took down the Francis Scott Key Bridge, enabling authorities to limit vehicle traffic on the span, Maryland's governor said. The ship struck one of the bridge's supports, causing the structure to collapse. The vessel caught fire, and thick, black smoke billowed out of it. With the ship barreling toward the bridge at, quote, a very, very rapid speed, authorities had just enough time to stop cars from coming over the bridge, Maryland Governor Wes Moore said. These people are heroes, Moore said. They saved lives last night. The crash happened in the middle of the night, long before the busy morning commute on the bridge that stretches 1.6 miles and was used by 12 million vehicles last year. The six people still unaccounted for were part of a construction crew filling potholes on the bridge, said Paul Whitfield, the state's transportation secretary. A senior executive at the company that employed the construction workers said Tuesday afternoon they were presumed dead, given the water depth and the length of time since the crash. Jeffrey Pritzker, executive vice president of Bronner Builders, said the crew was working in the middle of the bridge when it came apart. No bodies had been recovered. This was so completely unforeseen, Pritzker said. We take such great pride in safety, and we have cones and signs and lights and barriers and flaggers, but we never foresaw that the bridge would collapse. Rescuers pulled two people out of the water. One person was treated at a hospital and discharged hours later. Multiple vehicles also went into the water, though authorities did not believe anyone was inside. A police dispatcher put out a call just before the collapse, saying a ship had lost its steering and asked officers to stop all traffic, according to Maryland Transportation Authority first responder radio traffic obtained from the Broadcastify.com archive. The collapse is almost sure to create a logistical nightmare for months, if not years, along the East Coast, shutting down ship traffic at the Port of Baltimore, a major shipping hub. The next story is called Justices Seem Likely to Keep Abortion Pill Access. The Supreme Court seemed likely Tuesday to preserve access to a medication that was used in almost two-thirds of all abortions in the U.S. last year, in the court's first abortion case since conservative justices overturned Roe v. Wade 2 years ago. In nearly 90 minutes of arguments, a consensus appeared to emerge that the abortion opponents who challenged the Food and Drug Administration's approval of the medication, mifepristone, and subsequent actions to ease access to it, lack the legal right or standing to sue. Such a decision would leave in place rules that allow patients to receive the drug through the mail without need for an in-person visit with a doctor, and to take the medication to induce an abortion through 10 weeks of pregnancy. Abortion opponents asked the justices to ratify a ruling from a conservative federal appeals court that would limit access to mifepristone, one of two drugs used in medication abortions. That ruling had immediate political consequences, and the outcome in the current case, expected by early summer, could affect races for Congress and the White House. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, March 27th, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Fiona from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. That's 515-243-6833. There are no obituaries for today, so I'm going to move on to the sports section now. This first story is called Iowa's Clark Inspires Next Generation, and it's by John Marshall. Caitlin Clark makes pulling up from the midcourt logo look easy, routinely hitting shots most players would consider a heave. The Iowa star's deep range has expanded the scope of possibilities for up-and-coming women's basketball players, much the way NBA star Stephen Curry changed the men's game more than a decade ago. Guys will say the game is not as fun to watch, but Caitlin Clark is fun to watch, said Shay Ijoy, one of Arizona's top high school players and a Stanford commit. I think she's inspiring a lot of young kids, my age, older, younger, and you can have that confidence and do it just as well as any guy could. Clark's ability to shoot three-pointers from mid-court logos at arenas across the country has changed the sport and the perception of it. The 6-foot senior from West Des Moines became Division I's all-time leading scorer this season. A three-pointer clinched it, a first-time All-American, and has filled up the record book during one of the best careers in women's college basketball history. Clark's reach has gone beyond the basketball court in the form of endorsement deals and fan interest, everyone wanting a part of the transcendent player. Young female players want some of her game, too. Clark's shooting from well beyond the college three-point line, the NBA line for that matter, has been unlike anything seen in the women's game before. Combined with her confidence, court vision, and awareness, work ethic, and team-first mentality, Clark has set a standard that's hard for young players to miss. She's part of the dialogue when players are talking about a logo three or a great pass she made in transition and uncanny ability to answer the bell in the biggest moments, said Sue Phillips, coach of powerhouse Archbishop Mitty High School in California and USA Basketball. I think that really speaks to that innate ability as well as the time she's put in. And this just doesn't happen by accident. It's clear she's worked on her craft. Nearly every player in Division I basketball was the best on their team in high school. At the college level, the players are bigger, more athletic, so scoring does not come quite as easy. Clark has the scoring part down, but with the all-around game to go with it, she's a superb passer with a high basketball IQ, the type of player who seems to see things before they happen. Clark also isn't afraid to mix it up on defense, sets screens, and is an excellent rebounder, all things coaches can point to for younger players. It's a good model to show all the other girls coming up, like, hey, you don't have to just shoot 30 times a game, said Tony Darden, Ijoy's coach since second grade, who runs Darden Sports Skills Academy. You have to learn to do other things, because when you get to that next level, everybody else is going to be able to score just as good as you. How are you going to stand out? Clark has taken it to a different level. Off the basketball court as well. As Clark has become the face of women's basketball, her face is everywhere. She has lucrative NIL deals with Nike, Gatorade, Buick, and was featured in a State Farm commercial with Jimmy Butler and Reggie Miller. Above this story is a picture of Caitlin Clark. It's captioned, "As Iowa guard, Caitlin Clark has become the face of women's basketball. Her face is everywhere." She's seen pumping her fists up in the air wearing her Iowa 22 jersey. The next story here is titled, "Brave Strider Looks Dominant." Spencer Strider is one of baseball's most dominant pitchers. That's not enough for him. The Atlanta Braves ace is looking to make things even tougher on anyone who steps up against him in 2024. Still miffed about the way last season ended, with another loss to the Philadelphia Phillies in the NL Division Series, Strider spent spring training, working on a curveball that could make his repertoire nastier than it already is. In sort of analyzing the way the season ended last year, and the season as a whole, the outcome is that we were not, and myself in particular, we were not as good as we needed to be to complete our ultimate goal of winning the World Series, Strider said. You start addressing that by improving where you can. One of the ways I could improve was to try to adopt this curveball. In his first full season as a starting pitcher, Strider certainly had plenty of reasons to be proud of himself. He was baseball's lone 20-game winner, finished fourth in the NLCY Young Voting, and broke Hall of Famer John Smoltz's franchise record for strikeouts in a season by punching out 281 hitters. But Strider lost both starts in the NL Division Series against the rival Phillies, including the decisive Game 4 in raucous Philadelphia, where he surrendered 3 runs in a 52-3 innings, all of them on solo homers. While his career record in the regular season is a dazzling 37-10, Strider has yet to win in the postseason, also getting roughed up by the Phillies in his lone start on the 2022 NLDS. "My job as a pitcher is to help us win games, win championships," he said. "No one is giving you a trophy for winning 162 games. That's kind of the perspective I have. Because this is a team sport, my job is to contribute to the collective goal of trying to win a team trophy. That's the World Series." The next short story is called AP Source D-backs Add Montgomery. The Arizona Diamondbacks and pitcher Jordan Montgomery have agreed on a $25 million one-year contract with a vesting option for 2025, according to a person familiar with the deal. The person spoke to the Associated Press on condition of anonymity Tuesday night because the agreement was subject to a successful physical. The option for next year can become guaranteed to Montgomery if he makes at least 10 starts this season. The addition bulks up the defending NL champions rotation just days before the regular season begins. Montgomery should slide into the number 3 or number 4 spot once he's ready for game action, joining Zach Gallen, Merrill Kelly, and Eduardo Rodriguez, who signed an $80 million 4-year contract with the Diamondbacks earlier in the offseason. ESPN first reported that Montgomery and the D-backs had agreed to a deal. Montgomery, who turned 31 in December, went into free agency for the first time as a World Series champion. The 6-foot, 6 left-hander played a significant role in Texas's first title after being traded at the deadline for the second year in a row. While the Rangers surely would have liked to bring back Montgomery, they weren't in position to pay the increased cost to re-sign him. He made $10 million last season. The next story is called Tover Rockies Finalize 7-Year Deal. Shortstop Ezekiel Tover and the Colorado Rockies finalized a $63.5 million 7-year contract on Tuesday, a deal that includes a team option for 2031 that, if exercised, would boost the agreement to $84 million over 8 seasons. The 22-year-old gets a $1.5 million signing bonus and salaries of $1.5 million this season, $4 million in 2025, $5 million in 26, $8 million in 27, $11 million in 28, $14 million in 29, and $16 million in 2030. The Rockies' option is for $23 million with a $2.5 million buyout. Tovar's deal supersedes a 1-year contract agreed to February 29th that called for a $745,000 salary while in the major leagues and $361,000 while in the minors. He has already proven he is one of the best shortstops in baseball, and we see him as a cornerstone of this franchise for years to come, Rockies general manager Bill Schmidt said in a statement. Tovar, a Venezuelan native, made his big league debut on September 22, 2022, and last year became the youngest Rockies player to start on opening day at 21 years, 240 days. He hit .253 with 15 homers, 73 RBIs, 11 stolen bases last season. He had 166 strikeouts and 25 walks. His .988 fielding percentage set a record for rookie shortstop, topping .987 by the Rockies' Troy Tulowitzki in 2007. Tovar signed with the Rockies in 2017 for an $800,000 bonus. The next story is called Kemp Agrees to $1 Million Deal with the Orioles. Infielder/outfielder Tony Kemp agreed to a $1 million one-year contract with the Baltimore Orioles on Tuesday, 1 week after the 32-year-old was released from a minor league deal with the Cincinnati Reds. Kent was 7-for-21 in 8 spring training games with 1 homer and 5 RBIs. He batted .209 with 5 homers, 27 RBIs, and a career-high 15 stolen bases last year in 124 games for Oakland. Kemp had 44 walks and scored 42 runs. Kemp has a .238 career average with 35 homers and 184 RBIs in 8 seasons with Houston from 2016 to 2019, the Chicago Cubs in 2019, and the Athletics from 2020 to 23. His deal with the Reds had called for a $1.75 million salary if he had been added to the 40-man roster. Baltimore opened a roster spot by designating infielder/outfielder Nick Mattin for assignment. The next story in this sports section is called NFL Owners Approve Kickoff Overhaul. It's by Rob Matty. Kickoff returns are returning to the NFL. Team owners on Tuesday approved a new rule that will take what essentially had become a dead play and make it an integral part of the game again. "We feel this is a great day for the NFL," said Saints special teams coordinator Darren Rizzi, who was heavily involved in creating the framework for the new hybrid kickoff. "The major overhaul to special teams, which has been in the works for years, takes elements of the kickoff rules used in the XFL and tweaks them for use in the NFL beginning in 2024. The rule will be in play for one season on a trial basis and then be subject to renewal in 2025. NFL Competition Committee Chairman Rich McKay said the new rule passed by a 29-3 vote. "There was little fear of the unknown," McKay said. "I think the optics are definitely the most drastic rule change we've seen. The thing that gives us all the comfort is we have the tape, we've seen it. We can show you the plays and you can see how this can play out." McKay said there was urgency to vote on this rule before the draft because it could impact the way teams structure rosters. "There were 1,970 touchbacks on kickoffs last season that now could be returns. There were 92 fair catches last season that are no longer allowed. Any ball caught in the field of play must be returned." "The kickoff returner's value is gonna skyrocket," Cowboys special teams coach John Fassel said. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell said he anticipates the league may have to tinker with the rule in the future, but considers this a big improvement. "I think it will bring the play back into a relevant play, an important play, an exciting play, and I think we can do it where the injury rate will drop," Goodell said. For a standard kickoff, the ball would be kicked from the 35-yard line. With a 10-kick coverage, players lined up at the opposing 40 with 5 on each side of the field. The return team would have at least 9 blockers lined up in the setup zone between the 30 and 35-yard line, with at least 7 of those players touching the 35. There would be up to 2 returners allowed inside the 20. Only the kicker and 2 returners would be allowed to move until the ball hits the ground or was touched by a returner inside the 20. Any kick that reaches the end zone in the air can be returned, or the receiving team can opt for a touchback in possession at the 30. Any kick that reaches the end zone in the air and goes out of bounds or out of the end zone also would result in a touchback at the 30. If a ball hits a returner or the ground before the end zone and goes into the end zone, a touchback would be at the 20, or the play could be returned. "It's a drastic kind of move that's going to be way different," said Ravens coach John Harbaugh, a former special teams coordinator. "Is that the right move at this time? I don't know. I think that's to be determined." Under current rules, any touchback, or if a returner calls for a fair catch in the field of play, results in the receiving team getting the ball at its 25. The proposal needed 24 of 32 votes to pass. "I'm all for it," Chiefs coach Andy Reid said. "You have 2,000 dead plays. Nobody wants to see that. It'll add excitement and newness." In other rule changes, the owners voted to make two tweaks to instant replay. Replay can now be used to review whether the game clock expired before the snap, and also can correct an obvious error when a passer was ruled down by contact or out of bounds before throwing the ball. Previously, those plays had been ruled dead at the spot, but now can be changed with clear evidence. If the pass is caught or intercepted, it would be down at that spot with no advancement. If the pass was incomplete, that would stand. The next story here is called LeBron-less Lakers stun Bucks in double overtime. Austin Reeves had a triple-double and made a tie-breaking three-pointer with 37.8 seconds left in the second overtime as the Los Angeles Lakers overcame the absence of LeBron James and rallied to beat the Milwaukee Bucks 128-124 on Tuesday night. Reeves had 29 points, 14 rebounds, and 10 assists in 47 minutes as the Lakers opened a six-game trip by winning their fourth straight despite trailing by 19 points in the fourth quarter and never leading in regulation. Anthony Davis provided 34 points and 23 rebounds while playing 52 minutes. Milwaukee's Giannis Antetokounmpo also had a triple-double with 29 points, a season-high 21 rebounds, and 11 assists. Damian Lillard scored 27, and Malik Beasley added 21 for the Bucks. James had an issue with his left ankle that prevented him from being able as the Lakers opened a six-game trip. For the Warriors versus Heat game, the final result was Warriors 113, Heat 92. Klay Thompson scored 28 points, Jonathan Kuminga added 18, and Golden State pulled away in the second half to win at still shorthanded Miami. Stephen Curry and Andrew Wiggins each scored 17 for Golden State, which led by 2 at the half and then led by as many as 22 points in the fourth. Bam Adebayo scored 24 points for Miami, which played without leading scorer Jimmy Butler, sidelined by an illness. The Heat also were without Tyler Herro for a 16th consecutive game, Kevin Love for a 14th consecutive game, and Duncan Robinson for a fourth game in a row. Haywood Highsmith and Terry Rozier each scored 15 points for the Heat. Jamie Jacquez Jr. scored 12, and Nikola Jovic had 11. For the Thunder vs. Pelicans game, the final score was Thunder 119 and Pelicans 112. Jalen Williams scored 26 points as Oklahoma City rallied with a 12-0 run during the final 2 minutes and 31 seconds to escape with a road victory over New Orleans, losing a 20-point lead in the third quarter. Josh Giddey scored 25 points and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander added 24, including a tying 3 with a minute and 29 seconds left. Zion Williamson had 29 points and 10 assists, and CJ McCollum scored 23 points for the Pelicans. And finally, for the Mavericks vs. Kings game, it ended with Mavericks 132 vs. Kings at 96. Luka Doncic scored 26 of his 28 points in the first half, and Dallas beat the Kings in Sacramento for their fifth straight win. Doncic added 11 rebounds, 6 assists, and 3 steals as the Mavericks moved into 6th place in the Western Conference, a game ahead of the Kings, with both teams trying to avoid the play-in tournament. At the top of these stories is a picture captioned "The Lakers' Rui Hachimura tries to get past the Bucks' AJ Green during the first half of Tuesday's game in Milwaukee." And it has the two players with the basketball, one of them's jumping up and about to throw the basketball over the other guy's head, and the other guy's trying to block him, but not doing very well. The next story is called "Young Enters Next Step in Surgery Rehab." All-star guard Trae Young will enter the next step in his rehabilitation from finger surgery, the Atlanta Hawks said Tuesday, but it's still not known whether he can rejoin the lineup. Young had a one-month follow-up examination to his February 27th operation to repair a torn ligament in his left pinky finger. The team said he is making progress in his recovery and will begin small finger motion exercises this week, but there was no timetable for his return to the Hawks, who are currently 32-39 and hold the final play-in spot in the Eastern Conference with about 3 weeks to go in the regular season. Young was averaging 26.4 points and 10.8 assists per game when he was injured in a February 23rd loss to Toronto. The Hawks are 8-7 since he went down, including a 120-118 victory Monday over NBA-leading Boston, in which they rallied from a 30-point deficit. The next few stories are from the NHL. The top one says that Zacha's goal gets Bruins by Panthers. Pavel Zacha scored the winning goal with 2 minutes and 21 seconds to go in regulation AS. The Boston Bruins defeated the Florida Panthers 4-3 on Tuesday night. The Bruins also broke a tie with Florida atop the Atlantic Division and now hold a 2-point lead, although the Panthers have played one less game. Charlie McAvoy, David Pastrnak, and Trent Frederick also scored for the Bruins, and Jeremy Swayman made 18 saves. The Capitals versus Red Wings, the Capitals were 4-3 in the Red Wings, it went into overtime. Dylan Strome scored twice, Charlie Lindgren made 30 saves, and host Washington beats Detroit in overtime in a pivotal matchup in the Eastern Conference playoff race. The Capitals moved 2 points ahead of Detroit and still have an extra game left to play. They're also right on the heels of Philadelphia for third place in the Metropolitan Division. For Devils and Maple Leafs, Devils were 6 and Maple Leafs were 3. Nico Hischier had a goal and 2 assists. Jake Allen made 42 saves, and New Jersey won at Toronto. Jake Hughes scored twice, including into the empty net, and Timo Meier added a goal and an assist for the Devils, who have won 4 of their last 5 games. Luke Hughes and Max Willman also scored for New Jersey. Jesper Bratt added 3 assists, and Curtis Lazar had 2. The Penguins versus Hurricanes, it was 4-1. Sidney Crosby had a goal and an assist, and the Penguins scored 2 goals on 5 shots in the second period, spoiling Jake Gentz's return to Pittsburgh in a victory over Carolina. Brian Rust scored his 23rd of the season and his 7th goal in 10 games. Jesse Puljujarvi added his 3rd of the season and 2nd in as many games for the Penguins, who were outshot 31-14 in the last 2 periods. Drew O'Connor added an empty net goal at 18 minutes and 4 seconds of the 3rd. And while we're not quite to an hour for today, that brings us to the end of the reading for the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for today, Wednesday, March 27th, 2024. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Fiona from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book A Culinary History of Iowa. Article we're reading now is entitled Manna Colonies Maintain Rich History in Iowa. The Icarians weren't the only communal society to play a role in Iowa's culinary history. The famous manna colonies in eastern Iowa were also founded on communal principles, but unlike the Icarians, the Amanas had a strong religious component. By the 1700s, people across northern Europe had become dissatisfied with the rituals and intellectualism of the Lutheran Church and had begun to rebel and separate from the Church. Adherents to a new faith called the Community of True Inspiration formed their own self-reliant communities. Known as the Inspirationists, these men and women and their families found refuge in central Germany. Persecution and an economic depression in Germany in the 1830s, however, forced the community to search for a new home. Hundreds of Inspirationists immigrated to America in 1843-44 in search of religious freedom. They pooled their resources and established a community named Ebenezer near modern-day Buffalo, New York. All property was held in common. Farms and factories were established, and the community of nearly 1,200 people prospered. When more farmland was needed for the growing community, the Inspirationists looked to Iowa, where attractively priced land was available. A committee was sent to inspect land in Iowa in the mid-1850s. The Iowa River Valley proved particularly promising. Here, the men found acres of rich soil, good timber, water, limestone, sandstone, and clay necessary for establishing a new community. Leaders chose the name Amana, meaning remain true, from Song of Solomon 4:8. Starting in 1855, six villages were established a mile or two apart, including Amana, East Amana, West Amana, South Amana, High Amana, and Middle Amana. The village of Homestead was added in 1861, giving the Amana colonies access to the railroad. Each village had its own school, farm, and craft industries to make it virtually self-sufficient. The communal way of life was continued in Amana, much like it had been in Ebenezer. All property was held in common. Families were assigned housing in buildings owned by the Amana Society. Each individual worked at a designated job. Religious life was the strong unifying factor. In the seven villages, residents received a home, medical care, meals, all household necessities, and schooling for their children. Property and resources were shared. Men and women were assigned jobs by the Village Council of Brethren. No one received a wage. Farming and the production of wool and calico supported the community. But village enterprises, from clockmaking to brewing, were vital. While crafted products became a hallmark of the Amana colonies, which are still known for exceptional wines and more. People were called to work before dawn by the gentle tolling of the bell in the village tower in Old Amana, where the pace of life was much different than today. More than 50 communal kitchens provided three daily meals, as well as mid-morning and mid-afternoon snacks to all colonists. These kitchens were operated by the women of the Amana colonies and were well supplied by the village smokehouse, bakery, ice house, and dairy, as well as the orchards, vineyards, and huge communal gardens maintained by the villagers. During the growing season, there was plenty of work to do in the gardens and kitchens, from planting and harvesting to preparing and storing vegetables, from cabbage to turnips. Around 1900, for example, it wasn't unusual for the communal kitchens in just one Amana village to produce more than 400 gallons of sauerkraut. It took a lot of food and labor to sustain the villages within the Amana colonies. Children attended school 6 days a week, year-round, until age 14. Boys were then assigned jobs on the farm or in the craft shops, while girls were assigned to a communal kitchen or garden. Work and faith were often intertwined and were intertwined in the villages, where the Inspirationists attended worship services 11 times per week. Times were changing by the early 20th century, however. Improved communications and transportation in the 1920s began to exert their influence on the Amana colonies. In addition, the collapse of the American economy following the stock market crash of October 1929 left no aspect of daily life untouched. The Great Depression and disastrous farm economy made the isolated communal life in Amana socially and economically impossible. In the early 1930s, Amana set aside its communal way of life. A strong desire on the part of the residents to maintain their community finally propelled propelled the change, according to Amana history shared by the Amana Colony's Convention and Visitors Bureau. By 1932, the communal way of life was seen as a barrier to achieving individual goals. Rather than leave or watch their children leave the community, the people of the Amana villages changed. Members voted to abandon the communal system and established the Amana Society Incorporated, a profit-sharing corporation to manage the farmland, mills, and larger enterprises. Private enterprise was encouraged. While this separated the economic aspect of the community from the church, the Amana Church Society continued to be the religious foundation of the community. Today, the seven villages of the Amana colonies are among the state's most popular tourist attractions. Declared a National Historic Landmark in 1965, the Amana colonies attract hundreds of thousands of visitors annually who come to experience a place where the past is cherished and hospitality is a way of life. The streets of the Amana colonies, lined with their historic brick, stone, and clapboard houses, their flower and vegetable gardens, and their lanterns and walkways, recall the Amana of yesterday. Many museums are available for tours, including the communal kitchen in Middle Amana, preserved just as it was on the day in 1932 when the last communal meal was served in the colony. The communal kitchen lets you step back in time. Guides explain kitchen routines and share insights on communal life. Guests can also enjoy a satisfying taste of Amana history and hospitality at the famous Ox Yoke Inn, a full-service restaurant founded in 1940 in the village of Amana. The Ox Yoke Inn's nationally recognized reputation of fresh, quality food served family style reflects the restaurant's old-world signature dishes. The Ox Yoke Inn serves traditional German and American favorites at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, as well as on Sunday brunch buffet. Glimpses of the past are also preserved in some of the gardens in the Amana colonies. With the passing of the old order in 1932, the number of the society's large vegetable gardens and orchards dwindled, but Larry Reddick and his wife Wilma still grow some of the colony's heirloom varieties in their fourth-generation South Amana vegetable garden. In 1980, they founded a seed bank to preserve heirloom plants for the future generations. In his 2013 book, Gardening the Amana Way, Reddick's chapters on modern vegetable and flower gardening in today's Amana colonies showcase his cottage and the meadow gardens, now listed with the Smithsonian's Archives of American Gardens. Old intermingles with new across Reddick's gardens as heirloom lettuce keeps company with the latest cucumber variety. It's a living tribute to the unique history of Amana colonies and one of America's longest-lived communal societies. And that was an excerpt from a culinary history of Iowa by Darcy Doherty, Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson. Yeah.